Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Well, good evening. I would like to welcome you to the Stop Child Abuse Now talk radio show sponsored by NASCA, which stands for National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And it is Tuesday, May 9th, 2022. This is scan number 2917. And my name is Penelope Bennett. I'm from Bellevue, Washington. And I am also an adult survivor of child abuse. On my host team this evening, and she's busy at work, is Annie Margis, also a longtime NASCA family member. Annie is from California as well, for your West Coast host team. So we welcome you this evening. Our type of show tonight is the Survivor Professional Night. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But before I talk about the show's format for this evening, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about NASCA and its mission, because as you know, NASCA is all about child abuse, trauma prevention, intervention, recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA, and it's to address issues related to child abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. The first goal, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. The second goal, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for literally anyone interested and the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And I'm very proud to be a member of our NASCA organization. Because tonight is an open panel forum type of discussion, we encourage you to call in, even if you've never called in before, to be a member of our panel. No experience necessary, just curiosity. The number to call in is area code 646-595-2118. Again, that's area code 646-595-2118. And my co-host, Annie, will greet you on our back line and welcome you into the show. So, and I'm getting a little echoing. I'm going to put you on listen-only mode real quick. I think that's coming from her mic, so I apologize, Annie, for doing that, but I think it might be coming from your mic. So, but please call in. I see we have a very robust panel already this evening. We have our founder and president, Bill Murray, on the panel, and we have someone listening in who's called to join us. So I'll leave, thank you for calling in, area code 317. I'll leave the rest of your number anonymous, but I wish to thank you for calling in, just listening. And also, I see a number from California. So I will ask Annie if it's okay to mention your name. It doesn't look like you're just listening, but just for the sake of anonymity, until I'm sure that those have called in that want to actively participate, we will be protective of your privacy, but we do appreciate you calling in, and thank you for calling in. So our type of show, as I mentioned earlier, it's a question-answer call-in discussion night with the survivor professional, We use an open mic forum. So the Survivor Professional evenings open mic forums are on Tuesday and Thursday nights. And we field topics that are brought to us by our listeners, our NASCA family members, and by our panel members. And we feature a special guest who's a adult survivor of child abuse and also a professional in a helping profession in terms of the recovery and healing process from trauma and abuse. And I am filling in for Felicia Johnson tonight. She was scheduled to be on, but she had a family emergency, understandably, so we wish her the best. But I am also a survivor professional. I am a trauma-informed trained professional. I am trauma-informed trained in mind, body, and spirit. I am a meditation mindfulness certified instructor, trauma-informed trained in mindfulness and also in yoga. I am also a certified health and wellness coach, and I also have an additional certification in actually sports nutrition counseling. So I've offered to step in tonight, and as a topic, I'd like to just talk about really mindfulness. We've heard about meditation mindfulness. Maybe you are practice mindfulness or meditation. Maybe you're curious, but I thought that would be a great topic to talk about. The elements of mindfulness, the benefits of mindfulness, and how mindfulness can be used as a modality in the healing process. And I'm happy to add my own experience in using movement, meditation, mindfulness as a healing modality in my own healing journey and something that I do on a daily basis. So that is the topic of the show this evening. And I am actually going to unmute everybody's mics because this is an open mic forum, but I'd really just like to begin by just talking about and defining, you know, what mindfulness is. And there's been a lot of different definitions of mindfulness, but, you know, in general, mindfulness has three key characteristics, and the first being it's just really an intention to cultivate awareness and return to that again and again. And we'll dive a little deeper into that key characteristic as the show continues. The second is a focused attention to what is occurring in the present moment through just a simple observation of observing thoughts, feelings, and sensations as they arise. And the third characteristic of mindfulness is an attitude that is non-judgment, curious, and kind. So to summarize again, the three characteristics of mindfulness is an intention to cultivate awareness, attention to what is occurring in the present moment, and an attitude that is non-judgment, non-judgmental, curious, and kind. So, as you know, as the go through the show this evening, you know, I want to break actually right now, and just you know, in terms of just defining mindfulness, see if there are any questions or comments, additions to the definition that I provided, and we usually go down the panel in the panel format. So I'd like to start with Annie. And just invite you to the conversation, Annie, and just see if you have anything to add to that definition of mindfulness or any questions that you have at this point.
I don't have anything to add. It made sense to me with what experience I have of mindfulness. What you said sounded like what I do, you know, and the reasons I do it. So, yeah, I don't have a question yet.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you. And I see we have someone that called in that's listening only, and we have someone that's called in from California, and I'm wondering, is the caller from California wanting to participate in the panel discussion?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you, Phil. Okay, so I'd like to thank you, Phil, for calling in. And see if you have any questions or comments just about as we define the concept of mindfulness.
How would you go about creating a non-judgmental attitude?
I was thinking, can you repeat that? How would I? Can you repeat what you just said? My apologies.
Well, you said something about a non-judgmental attitude.
Yes.
How would you go about trying to create that?
Now, that's a great question. That's a great question. So I think for me, that was probably one of the hardest things to actually wrap my brain around when I was, you know, learning to the concept of mindfulness and then, you know, how to take what I learned and actually teach it back and lead. I teach students in a college setting, mindfulness classes, actually they're academic classes. So how do I take that, understand it, and teach it back? So it's a great question. Because I think there's judgment all around it. I think you don't have to be an adult survivor of trauma or a survivor of trauma or abuse. But we all are faced with judgment, right, of ourselves and of others. That's just something that we're faced with social media. We're faced that, you know, there's a lot of opportunity to feel judged or to pass judgment in social media. You know, marketing, you know, the world around us. And so the judgment surrounds us, whether it's our own self-judgment or the judgment from others. And so, you know, how do we get into a place of not judging? And for me, I think the easiest way to, and when I lead students, I just say, can you just observe? Can you just observe and not label? So instead of saying, you know, you ever just had a feeling in your body, oh, this hurts, right? That's almost a judgment, right? So sometimes I just name, okay? There's a heaviness in my left leg. So it's really observing without labeling. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's more of an observation or taking notice of something without assigning an adjective to it. And I think as we go through, because that's a great question, and that's a really nice, mindfulness encompasses, you know, that non-judgment or non-attachment. And I'll describe non-attachment too. And so I think you've really hit kind of nail on the head. And so all the elements of mindfulness, as we unpack them and talk about the benefits, I think will also answer that question as we sort of peel back that onion. So how's that sound?
Perfect.
Okay, great. But keep the questions coming. So, and then I wanted to move on to Bill and just see if you had any comments or questions just about as mindfulness is defined or has been loosely defined by me.
I don't know. It's pretty loose, huh? Loosey-goosey. I don't know how much I practice mindfulness. I think I try to stay in the moment. That's how I express it as much as possible. In fact, when I feel myself kind of getting, squirrely and even depressed, I check out whether it's still in the moment or not, and most of the time I'm not. Because that's the first thing that goes. You slip right into sort of resentment and fear, and those kinds of things aren't in the moment. Those are things from either the past or the future. Which
exactly.
Is where I think I most often operate. If I bring myself into the present and stay in the present, I'm actually much better off than otherwise. So I think, I don't know how much you how much success you have teaching college students this, but hopefully they're getting a head start from where I came from, because I didn't learn it till later, quite a bit later. But of course, then I'm a trauma victim. So a trauma experienced person. So, but thank you for coming in today and doing this. You know, you didn't expect to do this, and that's also kind of, I think that's kind of part of it too. You respond to whatever occurs appropriately, and that's what you've done tonight. You know, you have a guest that was planned, and she couldn't show up, and you don't get a lot of warning when that happens, because, you know, she was planned for the whole month, because her this is her date, you know. So it's the second Tuesday, I think. Yeah. So she would always do the second Tuesday, and so she knew about it, and we all knew about it, and we didn't worry about it. But now you had to last minute step in, and that's great that you did. I'm also appreciative of the folks that are here and are going to participate with you too, and Phil and Geraldine and so forth. So, you know, I don't know that I have a lot more to say at this point, but I'm probably going to ask some questions because I feel confused sometimes about mindfulness. but we'll see. I actually do practice it, I'm saying, but I don't call it mindfulness, or I never did until I started hearing other people calling it that. But I recognize it because it is, for me, being in the moment, you know, staying in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So thanks very much for being here, and I'll stay with you on the show and help you out too.
Well, thank you, Bill. Thanks. And thanks for your comment. It's actually a great segue. Because I really wanted to focus on the first element of mindfulness being, what does focusing on the present moment even mean? And to be honest, when I heard of mindfulness and I heard about focusing on the present moment, I thought, what in the world is that? What is that? I mean, that was something that I never practiced that. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know the definition of mindfulness. I didn't know what, you know, the practice of being and focusing on the present moment was. I didn't even know what the present moment was. I mean, especially as, you know, adult survivor of child abuse, and I didn't start, you know, my healing journey until 46. I'm 52 now. And, I mean, my whole life had been, I was either in a state of complete dissociation or I was focusing on, you know, and living in patterns of the past or worried about something was going to happen in the future. So, you know, this was, I'm Greek, right? It was totally Greek to me. So I'm glad that you bring up that, you know, question of what the heck is just this whole concept of focusing on the present moment. And so I'm sort of kind of starting from the beginning. And first of all, just the whole practice of mindfulness, it's not a state that you get to. It's something that's fluid, and it's something that's learned. It's practiced every day. It's done over time. So it's not like a cram course where you can, you know, when I teach my students, it's just something that we start to learn and become aware of and, you know, try and increase and enhance our awareness, you know, as we live each and every day. So I just want to first of all say it's a journey too. Mindfulness is a daily practice. So don't be gentle on yourself as we, you know, I describe this. And if you want to start, you know, focusing more on, you know, mindfulness, just remember that this is just, you know, taking baby steps, and there's no, you know, perfect way to achieve, you know, mindfulness, if that makes sense. But I just want to unpack a little bit about, you know, focusing on the present moment. So for what I learned, especially as an adult survivor of child abuse, sort of living in a dissociated state and constantly, you know, living in old patterns, and either being drawn into, you know, fears about and remembering what happened in the past, which caused me anxiety about the future, you know, I never lived in the present moment. My mind was backwards or forwards, in the past or in the present, I mean in the future. So, you know, when you think about when your thoughts get lost in thinking about the past or worrying about the future, trying to bring yourself back to the present moment is really trying to just refocus your mind and your brain at that moment on just where you are and what you're experiencing right now. And you might have heard the term in the here and now, and you think, well, what does that mean in the here and now? Well, if you look at a clock and you look at the time, it's actually what is happening in real time. Not what happened 30 seconds ago, not what's going to happen in, you know, 30 seconds in the future, but in that very beat, in that very tick of the clock. So one thing that they really struggle with, well, how do I get, you know, to calm my mind and bring myself into the present moment? I'll just say, and breathing is a part of bringing your body into regulation, but and breathing is used in some mindfulness practices. We're not going to talk about really that today. But how I taught myself to begin the practice of trying to focus on the present moment is by just bringing my attention to my breathing. You know, noticing as the breath is coming in and noticing as the breath is coming out. Because what I realized is with every breath you take, if you're really focusing on just your breath coming in and out, you can't take a breath in from the past, even 30 seconds ago. You can't exhale. You can't breathe out into the future, you know, if you were to fast forward 30 seconds. With every breath you take, you're actually in the present moment. So your breath brings you into the present moment. So you can focus on your breath. You can also focus on what's happening in that moment. And so one way that I also, you know, have taught myself and teach my students is, you know, if you want to focus on your breath, what's happening in the present moment, and focus on the breath and the breath out, then you might also want to focus your mind on how your body feels in that moment, right? Or how your mind feels in that moment. How's my mind feeling? Do I have thoughts piling up on top of one another? Or, you know, is my mind calm? Or is my body, you know, tense? Or is it relaxed? So that's one way to bring yourself into the present moment. So if you try while you're breathing and focusing on your breath to remain open to how things unfold in the present, you know, rather than having preconceived ideas about how things will or should turn out, you know, you can start bringing your mind to the present moment. So I want to see if there are any questions about just that element of mindfulness of just focusing on the present moment, wondering if that was clear. So, Annie, was that clear? Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I was just thinking as my mind was wandering instead of being mindful that I was taught not to be mindful, in fact. I was taught to pray silently all the time, that we're supposed to always be reciting our prayers, and that totally would take me out of the present moment.
Yeah.
That just occurred to me, so I thought I'd share it.
Well, no, thank you for sharing that, right? Where you're focusing on something else, right, versus focusing on just being aware of what's, you know, what's going on in your body or in your mind in front of you, right? If you're being told to pray and focus on something else, you can't really focus on how you're feeling, right? Or what's really going on around you. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I want to see if Phil has any, you know, questions or comments about just that element of focusing on the present moment and how it was described.
No, not right now.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, I guess I was trying to say something, you know, along the lines of what you just said, but using different language, of course, because my experience wasn't, I did do some attempts at meditation, but I found that was really difficult for me because, you know, of what Annie just said, it's very hard to keep your mind in the present at all. I mean, I can't do it for more than a minute, really, even that, more than a few seconds, you know, without it drifting either to the future or commenting on the past, you know, making a thought about the past, either one of which takes me out of the moment. And sometimes I ping back and forth, ping, 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 you know, and that's probably not too comfortable either. I think the trick is to calm down. I mean, breathing does do that, and I learned that in the first little while of my recovery. But it does calm you down. And I used to be so, I had no idea that this was going on, but I used to be so anxious and depressed. And anxious is about what's going to happen, and depressed is what's already happened, and also a fear that it's going to stay that way. It's going to come back all the time. You know, that's going to be the permanent condition. You know, so I'll be anxious about being depressed. How's that?
Yeah, that's thank you for sharing that. And so I have a question for you. When you're trying to practice, or past, and you've been trying to practice, you know, being in the present moment, and then your mind wanders and you start thinking about the past or having anxiety about the future, what do you do?
Right.
What do you say to yourself in your head? Do you quit trying to meditate, or how does what happens next?
I select a very simple prayer or two that I attempt to work my way through silently, but I try to work my way through. And the object is to get all the way through the prayer without having some significant mind drifting. It's very hard.
Yeah. Okay.
and then the other deal is that as I'm saying the prayer, when I realize my mind is not there, I have to go back and start over. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to practice being in the moment by using, I guess it would be a mantra, but mine is a prayer where, you know, I'm just trying to really understand what it is I'm saying. That's what I mean by staying in the prayer and not going somewhere else. How about the serenity prayer? Everybody knows that, right? So God grant me the serenity. And by the time I say God grant me the serenity, I'm somewhere else already. And you can do that with anything, with our Father, with anything.
It's tough. I wasn't trying to set you up, but I just was curious as to, you know, how you handle that, you know, if you're trying to calm the mind and stay in the present moment, you know, how... I'm sorry about my phone ringing in the background, so we never have any phone calls, and then all of a sudden it's ringing. But the reason I'm asking is because, you know, that was something that I had to learn as I taught mindfulness, and I led my classes through mindfulness. Here's the thing. The mind is a muscle. The mind is a muscle. So we can train our minds. But everyone's mind, even the most experienced, you know, meditation, mindfulness practitioners, their mind wanders. Or like my phone just rang. You'll be trying to be in the present moment. You'll be breathing and just trying to focus, and the phone will ring. You'll get really irritated. And then your mind will wander. And so what I've learned and how I teach is that interruptions will happen and your mind will wander. And the more you get frustrated with yourself and admonish yourself, right, or try and camouflage the fact that your mind is wandering, your mind will wander more. And what I teach in my classes is, instead of getting upset that your mind is wandering, you know, I accept that my mind is wandering. And I'll tell myself, okay, mind, thanks for sharing, but I'm trying to practice mindfulness right now. So I'll get back to you later, and I'll gently guide my awareness, guide my mind back to my breath, and focus on the practice. And what happens is, if you don't acknowledge the distraction, if you try and fight it, it actually becomes bigger, becomes more pronounced. So actually, by acknowledging the distraction, okay, mind wandering, okay, worry about the future, okay, phone ringing, acknowledge it, you give it less power, and it becomes smaller, and then you can gently guide your mind, you know, don't admire, just guide yourself to say, okay, that's okay, it happens, I'm going to go back to my practice. So that is something that I tell, and that takes practice, And actually not to beat ourselves up for trying to be in a mindfulness practice in the present moment and having our mind wander, you know. But instead of being forgiving, you know, name what's happening, acknowledge it, or just say, you know what, I'll worry about you later. Right now I'm doing this, and gently guide your awareness back. Like I said, the mind's a muscle, and the more you practice that, the more you'll realize, you know, you'll have less interruption the more you do it, but you're still going to have interruption. You're still going to have a mind wandering. So I'm not saying what you do is you know, I wasn't judging it, but I was actually, you know, wanted to, you know, engage in the discussion of, you know, and acknowledge the fact that these interruptions happen, especially if we're starting, you know, to practice mindfulness. And that's okay. And that's the strategy that I use and that I've learned to use. And I teach my students on how to address that. The next element of mindfulness I want to talk about, I'm going to talk about two more and then I'll break to the panel again. An element of mindfulness is actually openness to experience. So rather than dreading and shutting out your own feelings and experiences because you think you can't handle them, you know, you actually welcome with curiosity any thoughts and feelings that naturally arise. So that was a novel concept to me, actually, instead of shutting out feelings that were bad, but actually welcoming them, just being a little bit of curious, and entering them more with curiosity rather than with fear. So that is just one of the elements of mindfulness, is openness to experience. The next element I want to talk about is non-judgment, and that gets a little bit back into what Phil brought up. So, you know, how do we practice non-judgment in a judgmental society, or if we've been judgmental with ourselves, or if others have been judgmental of us, and that is something that has been judgment and something that's been practiced for a period of time. So, it's just a practice as well. So becoming aware of the fact that you're going to try and categorize your thoughts, actually you're not going to categorize your thoughts and feelings as good or bad, or you're not going to try and change them, but that you're just going to observe them, is a practice. But just even bringing up the awareness of knowing that you're going to try not to judge. So anytime a feeling comes up, feel dread or also this is bad, and then I'll remind myself, you know, can you just acknowledge that feeling without a label, but instead just acknowledge it for what it is. So, but the more you become aware and with the intention that you're not going to judge, but you're just going to observe, that becomes more of a practice. That takes some time. But that is really the whole essence of non-judgment, is not to categorize your thoughts and feelings as good or bad, not trying to change them, and not feeling compelled to act on them, but that the feeling is it has a purpose, and be a little curious about that purpose. You know, maybe the feeling comes up because it's a protective one, or it opens you up for something else. It doesn't mean that you're okay with your feelings or that you want to feel sad or you want to feel anxious. It's not saying that when you accept them, acceptance doesn't mean that you're okay with your agreement. Acceptance actually means that you're just observing it as being a factual thing, observing it as truth. So that's another, you know, element of mindfulness is acceptance, and really what the definition of acceptance is. So again, just to review, we talked about openness to experience and non-judgment. So openness to experience, rather than dreading and shutting out your own feelings and experiences, you welcome curiosity and non-judgment. You're not categorizing your thoughts and feelings as good or bad or trying to change them. You're just becoming curious about them and acknowledging them for what they are. So, and there's a lot in mindfulness, so I know we're going to get through a lot in an hour and a half, but that's like why I like to break every so often and break to the panel. So, Annie, I just want to invite you back into the conversation and see if that all makes sense, if you have any questions.
Yeah, the idea of being non-judgmental about my thoughts brings me to the pre-recovery self, when my thoughts were all judgmental and they were all negative and they were all accusing me of things. I don't have those. Well, I do. I mean, they pop up now and then, but they aren't, you know, the fabric of my life anymore like they were. Mm-hmm. And I do know how to be non-judgmental of myself and to be gentle and kind to myself when memories and things interrupt my focus. So that's mm-hmm. all. Thank you.
Good. Are you, thank you. So I just wanted to, as we're going down the panel, ask you if you had any questions or comments, if that made sense of what I've just shared.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
This is Geraldine Colum.
Oh, yes. Hello.
Hi. I just want to bring to the point where it might further detail the whole goal of mindfulness. And you might have a different way of looking at it. But we set goals, daily goals in our life. And when I'm getting all sort out of sort and out of the flow of work, I've got my goals set right there in front of me. And, okay, you've got to get through this 30 minutes. This is right now, and then I breathe. And then I say that I'm grateful for my life today, and I thank you, Jesus. And that brings me back into the flow of my work for that day. I'm grateful for my car. I'm going shopping. I'm going to get through the store, and I'm going to be safe. Thank you, Jesus. You know, that seems to help me stay in my mindfulness. I'm not worried about tomorrow. I'm not worried about a bill that has to be paid today because I know I've got a goal to pay bills at 6 o'clock. It's on my sheet of paper. It's on my notes. And I set goals for the a.m. part of my day, for the p.m. part of my day, and for the late p.m. I set different goals. That's how I stay in the mindfulness. Does that make sense?
Well, good. It does make sense. Absolutely.
That kind of helps break it down for people when I explain to them what I mean by mindfulness. But that's the way I explain it.
Thank you. No, thank you for sharing that. I think that's great. That's awesome. And I think, you know, you're in your mindfulness, that brings you into being mindful of your goal for that present moment, right? It's your focus.
Right.
And
your
it sounds
focus.
Like you do. Yeah. It sounds like you do it with non-judgment. You do it with gratitude.
Yes.
Yeah,
gratitude and forgiveness.
Yeah,
I forgive myself if I mess up on an appointment. Say I'll do that better the next time for that appointment. You know, I can't change that appointment right now, but I did make a call back, so I'll call them and I'll do better in with my words the next time. You know,
mm-hmm.
that's. The type of work I do, I make phone calls. And, yeah, I mess up. But it's usually because, just like you said, I've had a distraction. The dog's barking in the front room, and the caller's hearing that dog barking. And they're saying, oh, I hear your dog. And that dog is not supposed to be barking. So I'll get frustrated. And that will break my focus. So I'll look at my little goal sheet. Oh, got to get through this call. I got 5 minutes to make it. Okay. And I breathe and I set my pace. And it seems to work for me. And I believe that it has worked for many others. If you write down your goals for your tentative day and keep them in front of you and face them with gratitude and forgiveness.
Yeah. And forgiveness is, I think, an extension, right? It's an element of acceptance, too.
Right.
You know,
right. It's an element of acceptance.
I love that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And it sounds to me, too, like when you're on the phone, that dog is barking, you don't get upset, just acknowledge the dog barking, and then you brought your awareness back to your goal. It sounds exactly like you acknowledge the noise, acknowledge it happened, but I've got to, you know, that you bring yourself back in the present moment, which is your goal. That's a great example, too, of actually, you know, bringing yourself back to focus in the present moment and not being governed by the other things, right, that are distractions.
Exactly.
Not making it bigger than they are. That's a great example. Thank you. Wonderful.
Well, thank you for affirming that.
Oh, of course. No, and I appreciate you, you know, joining in the discussion. It's really lovely to have you on. Phil, I'd like to see if you had any questions or comments before I continue on.
If I could make a comment about the thing I said before, I illustrated how easily my mind drifts by trying to calm it. Really, I'm not very calm. I'm all over the place. And I said that one of the things that I do is I say a prayer. Now, a prayer for some people is something they're not ready to do, and I understand that. And there was a time when I wasn't ready to do it either because I was so pissed off at God, you know. But I came to understand that there's prayers and then there's prayers. There's the organized prayer like the Our Father that everybody knows, everybody says, all kinds of religions use it. The more generic, I think it's more generic, serenity prayer. And then, in the organization that I started to get healed in, which was Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a thing called the Big Book. And the Big Book is, it's actually the literature that came about from the first couple hundred people who got sober. They gathered themselves together. They wrote the book. They discussed the book. They made changes. And it took about 3 years for them to come out with what, you know, became lovingly known as the Big Book because they couldn't afford regular paper, so it had to come out on what they call rag paper. It's very thick. So the book was giant. It was very thick. It was the size of a telephone book, but it was only 164 pages, plus a couple stories and so forth in the back. And that 164 pages is the program. That's the description of the program, even today. So anyway, in the middle of that, there are what I came to understand as prayers. There are things in quotation marks where it's explaining the process of getting sober where they say, you could do this. You could say, God, I offer myself to thee to do with me and build with me the way you want, you know. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I can better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them might bear witness to those I would help. Of thy power, thy way of life. And that's a prayer. So what I would use there's two or three prayers from the Big Book and then the Serenity Prayer, which is also closely associated with AA. And those were the prayers that I mean. I didn't do, the Catholic prayers or whatever that I was brought up with. So these are the things, because I figured that what AA was trying to do is it was trying to instruct me the right way to pray, you know, what to ask for. And it turned out I don't ask for anything for myself in the prayers that they offer. You know, I unless it's by my healing, for example, I'm better able to help others, then it's okay. But I don't ask, you know, to better my life in any way. So I just wanted to say that because I didn't really use I didn't like say the rosary or anything, you know. I couldn't. I could barely get through the Serenity Prayer, much less anything else, you know. and because, especially because I made the goal for myself of going back when I realized my mind had drifted and re-saying what I'd already said so that I understood kind of every phrase all the way through the prayer. And I was kind of committing myself to every phrase. And when I realized my mind was off of it, go back and do it again. That's not easy, let me tell you. But it's because the program recommended these things, that I used them because I didn't want to, you know, I wanted to do it right, whatever that meant. I was very confused, very hurt. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about the other thing. Now, what was the thing we were just talking about? You were just talking about mindfulness.
Well,
is...
Yeah, and I was actually asking also Phil on the panel if he just had any more questions or comments as we went through, you know, some of these top elements of mindfulness, focusing on the present moment, but also openness to experience, you know, non-judgment of thoughts and our feelings and ourselves, and acceptance of things as they are. So I didn't know if Phil had any comments or questions about that.
No, you can continue.
Okay, great. But I think, you know,
well,
I
apologize, Phil. I thought she'd said Bill, but I want you to, and Geraldine to participate, you know? Come on, guys.
Well, it's fascinating that she's able to teach people in this, and I really praise you for that, because it is a tough subject. And people are not understanding what mindfulness is to some respect. It's hard for them to get there, and it's a tough subject.
I agree.
It is, and I think that we have to, you know, I think we have to be, thank you for saying that, we have to be gentle with ourselves. We have to be, you know, I think that whole concept of non-attachment, which is actually an element of mindfulness, that this is a practice. Every day is a journey, even learning, you know, how we can utilize mindfulness for us and really what works for us in our daily lives. Bill said that he uses prayer. Geraldine, you've said that you use, you know, a focus and an awareness of any distractions, and you have goals that you go back and focus on that are time-bound, and that you practice gratitude. And that you look to, you know, you look to your religion as well. And I think those are, you know, great ways, you know, to, those are some great shares. And I think that, you know, we have to just find, be patient with ourselves and not think that the practice of mindfulness has to be done one way or the other way. But I think we need to understand the benefits and the elements of it. And I think, you know, it's good to know, to make ourselves aware of that. And then to become curious and experiment and see, you know, what works for us. So this is all really great.
What I find interesting is that when I'm able to help someone understand it, I wind up with post-it notes all over my desk. Post-it note for 9 a.m. You got to get this job done. You know, and post-it note, forgive yourself if you don't get it done. You know, post-it notes are everywhere on my desk. I throw away so many post-it notes every morning and replan my day every morning. And once you build that habit for your daily walk, you become more focused and you're not distracted by having to concentrate on being mindful. But it's a habit. Mm-hmm. And it takes up to 60 days to create a new habit. It does.
Exactly.
It's
a practice, and that's exactly. It's a practice, and I just say be gentle with yourself and know that, you know, we have to give up, you know, our idea that we're going to, you know, understand something and get it down quickly, you know.
Right.
I think that's non-attachment. You know, we have to be able to be curious and forgiving, and we need to try, right, but also be gentle with ourselves and forgiving of ourselves and knowing that, you know, this is a process. And I think at least as an adult survivor of child abuse, when being perfect was my protection, you know, that was hard to let go of when I was really attached to how things should be. Or how I should act or how I should behave, you know, in order for me to survive, I think, you know, to learn through process to let go of that.
When you're a survivor, you don't have the skills to cope with life many times, and you have to start from get-go. I mean, and the get-go is letting go of that past. and that's working through it with a timeline and discussing things with a counselor. But most importantly, building skills and new habits. And keep in mind with oneself, it does take 60 days to create a solid habit in your life with each step that you take. Something that is just overwhelming for people to understand. And I don't know how to break it down any further than that. But to seek success is to learn. So keep learning, you know, and keep developing an understanding. But most importantly, set goals day by day.
So go on.
Well, I just want to say that to me, the concept of mindfulness is down the road from the beginning of my whatever my recovery is. I have to kind of not worry about mindfulness until I'm ready, you know, because there's just so much in my lap when I'm
exactly,
you know, getting out of trauma. And I'll tell you what, as I said before, I used the step work of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's laid out in a way that I think you're supposed to do it in that order. And I tell you, you know where meditation is? Step 11 out of 12.
There you
it's
go.
Way down the line.
There you go.
I think that's because, you know, you have to get ready. There's so much going on. All the amends that you make and the lists of resentments and the fears and all that, they're all way earlier than when you're at a place where you can finally be able to meditate. So now here's another idea. I used to do what Geraldine's suggesting of writing on a yellow pad. My goals for the day, the things I wanted to achieve in a day. And I would, you know, it was like a full yellow pad and even more sometimes of items that I wanted to get done. And then what I would do is I would go through the day, and when I got one done, I'd put a check mark on it, you know?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I'd look at the list, and I would be so depressed, because, you know, I only got a certain number of them done. I didn't finish them all. This was really hurting me because this was before recovery, but I owned a business, and a lot of these things had to do with the business, and you know, and I even put little things on there, which was probably wrong too. But I would check a few things off, and at the end of the day, I'd look at the list, and I would beat myself up. Oh my God, how could you only get that much done? You know, and what I learned in recovery was that, you know, it's okay to do the list, of course. But even if you get like three things written done off the list or five things and the list is 25 things, what you do is you congratulate yourself for the five things and you put the 20 on the next day's list. It's just that simple. Instead of beating myself up for what I didn't do, I started to appreciate what I was able to do. And that meant a great deal to me when I finally figured that out. I still wasn't able to do the whole list, but, you know, I just felt better about what I was able to do. Yep, Penelope.
So, Bill, you just really nicely described, right, before recovery, your list of 30 things that you would beat yourself up if you didn't get them done. So that's a nice example of attachment, right? I need to get these 30 things done, right? And a nice example of non-attachment is saying, okay, you know, not focusing on what you didn't do, but just and not holding on to that, but just acknowledging what you did do, right? So non-attachment
is
just, you know, not setting those expectations, but instead, you know, reflecting upon what
you
did.
And when I explain this to newcomers who I was sponsoring, because, you know, in AA, you sponsor people when you have a little under your belt, then there's newcomers. So the people that I was sponsoring, and I sponsored a lot of people at one point, I used to explain this by giving them an illustration that they could they could actually see in their mind, which was that every time you did something that was on the list, you gave yourself a mental gold star, the same kind of gold star that your first grade teacher would give you if you learned how to spell all the words right or whatever. And you get a gold star, you were happy to get a gold star, and boy, you know, it meant something to you. It was meaningful. And yet it was a little teeny paper, you know, little tiny piece of paper, but you can do that in recovery too. So when you do something right, give yourself a mental gold star. And at the end of the day, rather than look at all the stuff you couldn't do, look back at the gold stars and go, wow, I did pretty well today. If you look at all the, and I, by the way, recommend that every small thing you're able to do in the right direction becomes a gold star. Not big things, little things. And they all matter. They all count. And if you look at things this way, you could have like a whole group of gold stars at the end of each day. And then, of course, tomorrow comes and you start over. But every day there's an opportunity to do, you know, to do that list and to give yourself a gold star for anything that's on. And it may be, there may be things that are not on the list, but you're happy about that you were able to achieve or do or accomplish. You know, they're all gold stars. There's a lot of gold stars when you look at it that way. You know, and you get to pat yourself on the back. So I actually used to do that. And I'd recommend that to my sponsees.
And it clearly served you well. Annie, I want to have Annie weigh in because I'm seeing people start to drop. I just want to make sure that I can get everybody in on the discussion as well. So, Annie, I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to come back on and comment or have any questions for what's been shared.
Sure. I'm still here. And I would like to say that, like Bill and like Geraldine, I make a list, not of like what time I'll do things, but simply a list of things I want to accomplish. And I cross them off when I'm done, like they're gone. That makes me happy. And then ones I don't finish go on tomorrow's do list. And I do celebrate. I'm going to get some gold stars. I think that's a great idea. And I celebrate. And I think that does keep me focused on today as opposed to obsessing about other times in the past or future.
Right.
Because that's really an important component, and that brings us back to really the essence of mindfulness is how do we, especially as survivors of trauma or adult survivors of child abuse, how do we stay focused in the present moment and not ruminate on the past or worry about, you know, the future, you know, and mindfulness is a tool. Will never be, you know, there's no such thing as perfect. Of course, it's a, you know, recovery is a journey. But it's a, you know, these are great tools in helping us navigate through the process and, you know, build some healthy strategies and habits of becoming more mindful and regulating the brain, right? Going from dysregulation, which is the prior trauma, to, you know, a regulated state, which is more of being able to focus and not being governed by our past or worried about what's happening in our future. So these are some great, you know, we're all sharing really great things that are working for us. One thing I tell my class, and this is, of course, you know, coming in either to a yoga class, which is normally an hour and a half, or, you know, when I teach mindfulness or I do mindfulness or meditation sessions for my college students, I just tell them, okay, for the next hour, you know, this is a gift to yourself. So if you can, when you enter the door of the classroom, could you leave your stresses and worries at the door and just come in and let's just focus on what we're doing today, you know, right now for the next hour. And it's okay if those worries come up. Just remind them, you know, they're going to stay at the door for the time being. And then guide your mind back to what we're doing. And I remind them, you know, they'll be there for you if you want them when you walk out, you know. But can you give yourself this hour or this 20 minutes or this 10 minutes or this 5 minutes, you know, just to focus on the practice? And so that's just another. We talked about having goals for a day, or 30, you know, but sometimes what I do, especially in someone's beginning a mindfulness practice, is actually to break it down to smaller increments, you know, into 5 minutes. Sometimes it's a minute or 2 minutes, you know, or go to 10 minutes or 20 minutes or 30 minutes. Sometimes I think that doing something in a smaller period of time feels more doable when we're starting out than looking at something like a day. So that was just another thing I wanted to add about how I help my students transition into thinking about, you know, starting a daily mindfulness practice is actually starting with smaller increments of time. I know we're at less than 30 minutes left, so I just want to talk quickly about some of the benefits and of just practicing what we talked about, what Bill has shared, what Gerald has shared, what Annie shared. But in terms of just practicing mindfulness, some of the benefits of that, we talked about the elements of it. But the benefits of mindfulness have shown, studies have shown, people can sleep better. They have improved sleep. They've also shown enhanced memory, concentration, and perception. So we talked about that, right? We talked about not being regular, you know, being dysregulated or worried about the past or the present, but being more able to focus on the tasks of the day. So that would be another benefit: enhanced memory, concentration, perception. The third thing, and I think Geraldine, you know, touched upon this really nicely. So increased levels of happiness and compassion. So those are considered among the most desirable long-term benefits of meditation and mindfulness. Another one is a healthier immune system. So because we, you know, calm the mind, so the long-term effects of mindfulness also entire benefit the entire body. So it shows that studies have shown that people that practice mindfulness produce a higher number of antibodies more rapidly than those who don't. So, of course, NASA doesn't make claims on this. But these are just some studies that have been conducted that show the trends of increased immune system. Mindfulness and meditation has also shown an improved alertness and ability to focus. So an improved alertness. So I think, you know, Bill's example, Annie's example, Geraldine's example of the distractions that come in the day, like a dog barking when I'm, you know, on the phone doing my job. You know, I'm able to acknowledge the distraction, but stay alert, you know, and refocus my attention on my job or the task at hand. So those five benefits, and again, I'll just rattle them off very quickly. Five benefits: one, better sleep; two, enhanced memory, concentration, perception; three, increased levels of happiness and compassion; four, a healthier immune system; and five, improved alertness and ability to focus. So I don't know, does that sound about right, Annie, Geraldine, and Bill, or did I, you know, sound about right?
Yes. I might also add, Mel Robbins gives a real good depiction on awarding yourself, and it's called the high five movement. Every time you have something small in the day, go get in front of your mirror and take a picture of yourself high-fiving yourself because you love yourself. And I really like that idea. That's just one way of setting it into a habit of saying that you're grateful for what you have done, you know, and succeeded in it. That's real important, is to you know, love yourself. And the high-five movement, the book, Healthy Habits, I think it's Healthy Habits. I might be wrong there. But that's one healthy habit you can create for yourself to reach your mindfulness. Does that make sense?
It does. Actually, when I was becoming a certified health and wellness coach, there was actually a study that we had to read and learn that was produced at the study was conducted at Stanford University about that whole concept of high-fiving yourself, celebrating, literally cheering yourself on for the smallest accomplishments. It could be brushing your teeth twice a day if you've gone, wanted to go from once a day to twice a day. But that, you know, to to stop and recognize and cheer yourself on, you know, give yourself that high five, even in small things, propelled people to reach for bigger and bigger and bigger goals, you know, because they were cheering themselves on and celebrating their successes. So that absolutely makes sense. And I love that you shared that. There's actual science behind it. Yeah, that's
great. There is a science behind that, and it works. I mean, it helped me get into the habit of liking myself. For a long time, I didn't. For a long time, I didn't brush my teeth every morning. I didn't brush my teeth at night before I went to bed. And that was one of my high five moments. I brushed my teeth this morning. I didn't even think about it. It was a habit now. But it takes 60 days, that habit. So be patient with oneself. Be gentle, like you said. Be kind to yourself. We beat ourselves up over just any little thing these days, and it can become a destructive motive. And that destructive moment will keep you from becoming who you authentically are. So you don't want to listen to the voices that says, you can't do this. This isn't for you. You don't understand this. You want to keep trying and trying and trying until you succeed. And once you have success in any little thing, high five yourself. Give yourself appreciation.
I just love how you just explained that and showed that to everyone. And I think, you know, and I want to hear from Bill and Annie as well, but I know, you know, having done the shows, having heard, you know, so many different stories, I know that, you know, as children, we were not taught to love ourselves. We were not taught to speak to ourselves kindly. We were not taught self-care in terms of that concept. And really, the practice of mindfulness and meditation is an act of self-care, of self-love.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, it's part of the journey of healing. And I absolutely, and I want to also hear from Bill, and I want to hear from Annie on that, because this is all part of the healing modality is, you know, the self-care and self-love.
Absolutely.
So, Annie, I'd like to hear from you on that, what your thoughts are.
Well, I felt really bad about myself. I was really down on myself. And I don't know if I took 60 days to get to another place, but I know that I kept going back. You know, I know there wasn't anything permanent about my constructing a bill that I was happier with. For a long time, there wasn't anything permanent. And today, I still can slip back into what I said earlier in the show is, you know, resentment, which is the past, right? And fear, which is the future. Those are the places that I think about not being in the present, resentment in the past and fear in the future. Neither one of those is healthy, you know, and I have to try and balance whatever's going on in my life by seeing it as best I can in the moment. And I'm not really that great when I first start this process of healing, and I don't know how long it took to get a little better, but I can still slip back is, I guess, the point I'm trying to make. So it's not a permanent condition for me that you get to a place and then you get to own it. You know, you get to practice more. Penelope, I think that's what you get to
do. Yeah,
no,
you know, I'm actually nodding. You can't see me nodding through the phone line, but do you know the very famous psychiatrist or psychologist, Dr. Gabor Mate? He's written a book on, you know, he's done a lot of work. Yeah, Dr. Mate, he's the kind of mainstream, I think, if you, you know, wanted to read on the mind-body connection, trauma, and he's shared a lot of his own experiences. But he said something, Bill, that I think encompasses exactly what you just shared. And he practices mindfulness and you know, meditation and yoga and those things, you know. But he said, in terms of, you know, mindfulness, and he said, it's daily work to stay conscious. It's daily work to stay aware. It's daily work to be mindful of those patterns, you know. It's daily work. It's daily work. And I think we're, you know, you can't be human and not, you know, have that daily work if you want to be really present in your life and heal through these things. You know, we all, you know, to varying degrees, especially if you're an adult survivor of child abuse, have had horrible things, traumatic, you know, trauma in our lives that we need to resolve. And it's the human condition. So it's, you know, how do you navigate this world? And it's to what you shared, Bill, it's you're never done. It's daily work. Daily work. Stay aware.
Yep.
Daily work.
I agree.
Stay calm.
Yep.
Annie, any thoughts?
I do have a thought. Mostly when I'm trying to practice mindfulness, I'm doing it in my sauna while I stretch, and I focus on that part of the body that's stretching. And I wondered what is the connection? I mean, is that mindfulness if you're moving, or do you need to be still?
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad you asked that question. But is it okay, Bill and Gerald, if I answer that?
Sure. Yes.
So. And, you know, I'm a trauma-informed, you know, yoga instructor as well. So it absolutely is. And so, you know, one of the ways to nicely connect the mind to the body, and as an aside, and I know we've talked a lot about, you know, dissociative disorder, dissociation in you know, being adult victims of child abuse, you know, at some point, you know, we have this connection. And so one of the ways that I work with my students to reconnect the mind and body, to become aware of their body, of the sensations, to even bring them into the present moment, is to cue them and say, you know, focusing on your breath, that, you know, let's, you know, stretch the right leg, right? Flex the toes. And just take a moment to notice how that feels. Bring your attention to that area. And that brings you to the present moment, because not only the breath, but actually feeling your body is another technique that meditation mindfulness instructors use to bring, during a practice, to bring their, you know, students or their practitioners into the present moment, is focus on how your body feels. And it's great to do specifically, especially if you're moving and stretching, one part, because when you stretch, you know, one leg versus the other, you know, you're focusing on what you're doing. And then after the stretch, I'll tell my students, I just want to take a few breaths and just notice, don't judge, you know, how does, you know, one, your right leg feel versus the left? And they begin noticing these differences, and it brings you really more into yourself. Does that answer the question? So it's a great,
yes,
you know, modality to connect, to become mindful and to actually make that mind-body connection and to really bring you into that present moment.
I'm really glad that I've been doing something that's helping me. It is helping me.
How is it helping you?
It is helping me pay attention better, to when my attention wanders, to bring it back, and not be surprised that it wandered, and being more gentle about it wandering too.
Yeah.
More gentle with myself, it's okay.
Exactly. Another thing that is a big something that happens to some survivors of child abuse and dissociation is that they literally, in disconnecting the mind from the body, their sense of interoception, so actually feeling within the body, feeling where pain resides, exactly where and what location the body, you know, or feelings of hunger, feelings of thirst, that sense of interoception, your body's, you know, function. When you disconnect through trauma, it's harder to assess and make that connection. So, for example, in my own experience, and I completely split from my body, I just, you know, during a very brutal assault, I literally floated out of my body and was watching the assault from the air. I was looking down below. I couldn't feel any. If I had pain, I couldn't feel it. or sometimes I knew I was pained somewhere, but I didn't know where. And that sounds, you know, if you've had that experience, you can relate to that. But actually going through the practice of breathing and bringing my attention to a body part helped me to reconnect the mind and the body. And that's, you know, it's a yoga practice, also mindfulness practice and meditation practice to bring and reconnect and reintegrate the mind with the body. So I hope that made sense. But, you know, part of what you're doing too is you're just reconnecting your mind to your body. And sometimes when we do that too, we have a more sharp perception of when we're experiencing pain or the onset of pain. And that's actually why a lot of athletes do yoga too, is to make that mind-body connection. Like Tom Brady, I'm not going to say was a Patriots fan or a Buccaneers fan, but, you know, he's always so good at focusing on all the noise and focusing on what he's doing. But a lot of athletes too, they don't, you know, these professional athletes, they don't want to suffer an injury. That's their livelihood. So they really tune and hone in their proprioception, right, which is the opposite of interoception, you know, to really can laser, you know, really dial in on that, those bodily sensations of the body, and they know when something's amiss. So I hope that was clear.
Yes, thank you.
So, Bill, any other comments, or Geraldine, any other comments? We've gone through a lot on mindfulness and benefits of mindfulness and mind-body connection. And
well, I do have one comment.
Yeah.
I like to think about the bees, the honeybees, and the waspers. They all come after us, and we wave our hands. We don't like them, things of that nature. And that's all from trauma. We fear the bees because they would sting you. When a child first gets stung by a bee, the bee could just be walking around their arm. And they first get stung by that bee, then from then on, they viciously run for them or dodge them throughout their whole life. So what happens if you have a person that can stand and just hold their hand out into a beehive and they'll be fine?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that person is not afraid of being stung, number one, and they don't have the triggers of violent sting, so they're fine with it. And the bees don't sting them. So when you're suffering from a trauma, something that was painful for you at that moment, that will set on behavior in the future for that trauma, from that
mm-hmm.
trigger. I hope I'm explaining that correctly, but I didn't plan on discussing this. But just always think of yourself as a child, and what do you do when you see a bee? You dodge it. You don't want to get stung. That's because you've been stung, and you know it hurts. And that is something that you can think about when you're talking about trauma and the triggers. It's all just one step at a time. As a child learns, they learn that the bee can sting them, and it affects them for the rest of their life. Just like our words, they can affect us for all of our lives. And our traumas, we can work through them, but we'll always find more traumas inside of the traumas. It just seems that way anyway. It's a process of healing that we're speaking of, and being mindful. So we need to be mindful of what our triggers are,
mm-hmm.
and the behaviors that follow. And once we're mindful of what our triggers are, and what the behavior became, or the event caused the behavior, then we can further diagnose it and process
mm-hmm.
it in a positive light. My husband can stand there, and I'll say, oh, there's a bee. Oh, let me get it. He will pick up the bee and move it to a better place. Because he has no fear of that bee.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a living thing to him, and he don't want to harm that living thing. He has peace with that. I have yet to find that peace.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like bees, okay? I don't like them stinging me. So that's something I've always wondered, how I could ever get to that place, but maybe I will, huh? I'm going to make that call.
That's a great analogy. A great analogy.
Well, I hope it helps somebody. You know,
absolutely.
I hope it helps somebody. It's just a simple little thing that you can think of.
How our brains are wired can be wired.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to rewire a brain.
I don't know how I did it, but when I was about 6, I used to have to walk back and forth to first and second grade, those 2 years, in a town in New Jersey. And the walk was slightly over 2 miles each way, and which was, you know, that's a fairly good sized walk for a 6 and 7 year old. But I used to start out at our house and then pick up other people that went to the school along the way. I was the furthest, you know, away from the school, but for the first year, my sister wasn't even going to school. Then the second year, she was a year behind me, so she walked with me at least the beginning. So anyway, the point is that I had a long walk, and one day I was walking this walk, and there was a bulldog in, or maybe it was a boxer, but I'm not sure, that was in a yard. And somehow I got entangled with it, really. I don't know how I got that far, but I was bitten in the cheek, okay? And that was really shocking, of course. It was in my face, too. So the point I'm making, though, is I already loved animals. And the fact that I got bitten by the pit bull, or not, it wasn't a pit bull, but a boxer or whatever it was, it didn't affect how I felt about dogs or other animals. I already had a relationship that I felt, you know, was a good one with animals. And so when an incident occurred that wasn't, you know, totally comfortable, obviously, it didn't traumatize me. That's one of the few things that I can think of that was a, you know, like a, it could have easily become one of my traumas, and it just never did. I've always loved animals, and dogs especially are, you know, and horses. I don't know. I never even shied away from that yard going back and forth to school, as far as I remember, because I felt like the animal had made a mistake, didn't intend to hurt me, and regretted it, you know, afterwards. So, because the animal never attacked me again, it never attacked me the first time. I couldn't remember how this all started, but I don't know if that makes sense or if that was a good thing to say or not. You only have a few minutes left, but it didn't affect me, you know, because I think I already had an experience that was a good one with that class of animal.
And we know the nature of animals and dogs and certain breeds of dogs is to defend. Sometimes there's a lack of, you know, we already have knowledge of, you know, the behavior, the naturally, you know, the expected behavior of pets. I think, you know, we know that has been documented and expected. And I know that there are, you know, different temperaments per breeds. And I think when it comes to humans, and we, you know, that's a different animal, you know, in quotation marks, you know, human beings, that bite us, that's a different scenario. That's my own opinion. I mean, my fear and anxiety came from the inability to know when the next eruption would come, the uncertainty, the unknown. You know, we know that certain breeds of dogs are, you know, have different attributes. That's a known fact. That would be just my comment, you know. Mine was the unknown, the uncertainty of the volatility of behavior in the human being, in the human.
You know what? I can't agree with all of what you just said, because I have a sense that, see, dogs have trauma too. And
exactly.
The angry dog, the mean dog, is one that's had trauma. And it may be from being yelled at, being hit, being, you know, deprived of something. It may be, you know, being kicked, you know. But it's just, you know, there's all kinds of traumas that dogs can experience. They don't all have to. You know, the dog that's calm and likes people and wags his tail a lot and jumps around and so forth, that dog is not traumatized, never has been. And so they can afford to grow up and be happy, joyous, and free, you know. So I have the same sense that I can walk into a situation with dogs, for example. Dogs are a great example because they're a different species, but they have certain attributes that all of us can understand, like the trauma attribute. They definitely take on trauma, and they experience it. They all have that. They will have that the rest of their lives. You know, we talk about how we're traumatized for the rest of our lives, some of us, because they don't have psychologists. So they have this the rest of their life. And it's really hard on them when we traumatize them as puppies. And they're the angry dogs. But the friendly dogs are those that you can kind of recognize them, and they can kind of recognize us too. By the way, dogs are one of the animals that, you know, can sniff you, sniff the air around you or something, and kind of sense where you come from. And it's really wonderful that they can do that. It's their own, but it's based on their experience, because a dog that has had a bad experience really won't even do that. You know, they'll just charge, you know, defend, pull on the chain and all that stuff. So anyway, man, you've done a great job, Penelope. We're here at the end of the show, and you did a wonderful job. Go ahead.
Oh, no, thank you, Bill. No, thank you. I was going to say, my gosh, you know, time flies. I can't believe we're at the two-minute mark, and thank you. I'm very appreciative that you were open to having me, you know, lead the discussion tonight on my passion here. So appreciative, and I think we had a great discussion, and I'm so very grateful. I have a lot of gratitude for being able to spend this 90 minutes and talk about mindfulness, meditation, and a lot of the different, you know, strategies that we all use that help with that. I think it was a great show and very, very beneficial, and I love hearing what other people have done to help them become more present every day. That was really great. I wish to thank you, Bill, really, truly, for the opportunity for being on the panel tonight. I wanted to thank my co-host, Annie Marges. Thank you, Annie, for being on tonight. I wanted to thank Geraldine. Thank you so much for calling in and everything that you shared. I learned a lot from you tonight. I just wish to really thank you.
Well, thank you for sharing with us.
Oh, my pleasure and my privilege. So as we, you know, we wind down the show, I want to, again, let everyone know, please go on the NASCA website, which is www.nasca, which is NASCA.org. You'll find the archives of these shows. So this show will be available for download and look. Well, them all, the current show schedule, we're on 5 nights a week from 8 to 9:30 Eastern Standard Time. And also, we are a fully 501c3 nonprofit organization funded by our membership. So there's a donate button through PayPal. Even a few dollars help. So thank you in advance for your support of NASCA. And as I always say, as I wrap up the show, there are enough adult eyes in this world to be aware and to keep every single child safe. So if you see something, please say something. It's our moral responsibility to do so. Thank you so much. Thank you to my panel, to Bill, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
God bless. Love you all.
Thank you.
Blog Talk Radio.